Hello everyone, my name is Graham Bate. I'm a managing director with Accenture here in Calgary. And welcome to the Canadian Journalism Foundation's first JTalk series event in Calgary. Tonight focusing on covering the home team, how our local journalists are reporting on the oil patch and the governments and corporations that move within it. Accenture is very pleased to be sponsoring this event at such an important time for the Canadian energy industry. I've lived myself in Alberta for more than 25 years and watched the province evolve along with the energy industry. We've watched as Canada's climbed in the ranks of global energy producers and now find ourselves ranked second for crude oil reserves behind only Venezuela and ahead of Saudi Arabia, and second for overall energy security as reported in Accenture's recent 2014 Global Energy Performance Index, behind only Norway for measures of energy security. This is a report that we released at the World Economic Forum in Davos in January. It highlights the energy performance of 124 countries across key dimensions of economic development, security of supply, and environmental impact. In short, there's much to be proud of for the home team in our energy industry. That said, there remains much more to be done, and we're all keen to see how these issues unfold in your stories in the months and years to come. In the same Accenture report that we released at Davos, Canada received lower scores for environmental sustainability. That being said, there's much being done in the Canadian industry to address the issues. For example, the Canadian Oil Sands Innovation Alliance. To date, the members have collaborated to share more than 400 distinct technologies and innovations in energy, water, tailings management, among some of the most important areas, demonstrating how the industry can cooperate to tackle important common challenges. As we work with our energy clients in Alberta and around the world to address these and other issues they face, we believe that as technology and global energy demand continue to evolve, Alberta's industry will remain on the leading edge of change and innovation. So no better time than this evening for this topic and to talk about how these issues are being addressed in the media. So again, welcome on behalf of Accenture, and thanks for joining us this evening. I'd like to now call on Bob Lewis, the chair of the Canadian Journalism Foundation, to introduce the panel.
Thank you, and special welcome to all of you. It's great to be back in Calgary. Just to date myself, when I first started coming out here to visit my late folks, they lived in Parkland, which was a new suburb. And my dad, who had a small business here, used to work from home, and he and I would sometimes go to the mail, pick up the mail in Mindapore, which had a post office, and its distinguishing feature was the grain elevator. And now, of course, it's part of the suburbs that go all the way to Okotoks, I guess it is. So anyway, it's wonderful to be back here. I also now have two sisters and a brother who live here, keep me honest, as well. So nice to see them here tonight. I also want to thank BMO Financial Group. They are the ones who have sponsored the year-long series of J-Talks that we do, and we're very proud that we've started with this one here in Calgary. We hope this becomes an annual event. I also want to really thank Accenture, who has sponsored tonight's event, and we're really deeply appreciative. I also want to give a tip of the hat to Mount Royal University, our partner, and especially to Shauna Snow Caparelli, who's chair of the journalism school, and we really do appreciate the help they gave us in helping to shape tonight's evening. And of course, we are always thankful that CPAC is here to amplify our message across the country, and to CNW, which helps us get the word out about what we do. So with that, it's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's moderator. James Imbruco has worked in Washington for the Canadian Embassy, and in Toronto for Toronto Life and an economics think tank. He joined the Financial Post in 2010, covering technology and small business. He moved to Calgary 2 years later. And in 2012, he joined BNN, everybody's favorite news network, where he appears on shows throughout the day. He also has a very interesting Twitter handle, which might be an appropriate one tonight. His Twitter handle is @crudereporter. Jason, over to you.
Oh, thanks so much. Well, I'll try and live up to my Twitter handle, I guess, and just cut right to the chase. It's surprising that it's even taken this long to get a panel like this together. I was surprised to learn this was actually the first panel of its type and the first major CGF talk that's happened in Calgary, and it's really long overdue. In fact, one of the panelists and I were talking prior to this about the fact that really the media establishment in Toronto doesn't really give energy its due, which is surprising to us because this is a beat that is really the mother of all beats. It's something that the economics are obvious. A third of the Toronto Stock Exchange is resource companies. The environmental stories are, again, very in-your-face and obvious about what is necessary and what must be done in our energy sector. Politics, like never before, has been such a focus of this sector. It's become a single pipeline. It's become almost the defining position of an American presidency. It's shocking that a former U.S. president is now getting in a war of words with our prime minister about that same pipeline. It's all under our beat, and on top of all of that, we also have to know what paraffinic froth treatment means. So it's not the easiest thing to do, and it really is a test of any journalist's acumen, our ability to distill a story and tell everybody else why it matters. And hopefully we can figure a little bit about why it should matter more, I suppose, to the rest of the country tonight. So without further ado, I want to introduce a just amazing group of journalists that I have the pleasure of sitting next to right now. I'm going to start directly to my right with Claudia Cattaneo of the National Post, their Western business columnist. And I should say I did have the pleasure of actually working with Claudia for about 6 months in 2012 before I ended up abandoning print for the Bright Lights Broadcasting. And, of course, she has been in the business for many, many years covering the oil patch for not just the National Post, but also the Calgary Herald. Prior to that, she was with the Montreal Gazette and, I believe, the Toronto Star as well, briefly. She has a Master's of Political Science that she got from the University of Montreal, I believe. And I can just say, very as an aside, one of the sharpest analytical minds I've ever had the honor of encountering. So when we get to the audience Q&A, don't leave anything back for her. She's going to need to get it all. Same goes for Deborah Yedlin, although I have not had the pleasure of working with her directly. She's likely one of the most recognizable names in business coverage in Calgary. It always seems to come up. In fact, Andrew Leach, a University of Alberta economist, you probably saw his McLean's piece referencing you in a rather flattering light, actually, which is unusual for Andrew. He tends to...
I went to U of A, maybe that's why.
And then directly beside her, we have Gillian Stewart, who brings a very important academic perspective to this conversation. Unfortunately, the rest of us are nowhere near as educated or experienced. And she actually has an extensive journalism background as well, including 3 years, I believe, as managing editor of the Calgary Herald in the late 1980s. Currently writes for the Toronto Star and teaches journalism at Montreal University. And at the very end, last but certainly not least, because I'm afraid of all New Yorkers, is Clifford Krause. He's been with the New York Times for the better part of 25 years, and when I say the better part, I mean 23 and a half, probably a little...
24 and...
Journalists like to be specific.
265 days.
He's an author, and he comes to us from Houston, Texas, so we really do appreciate you making the long journey to be with us tonight. I want to jump right into a question that has actually several people have asked me to ask, which is really a virtue of this city that we're in, where it's a pretty common fact. I think many of you probably know that old statistic. 1 in 6 Albertans is employed in the oil and gas sector in some way. And so every one of us either has someone in our immediate family, in our close circle of friends, something like that, where we have a personal connection to the oil sands. And so one of the cardinal rules of journalism is maintaining that professional distance and avoiding any conflict of interest. But that is a particularly challenging thing to do when you're covering the Canadian energy patch and you're living in Calgary. I mean, I've only been here 2 years, but I have a little subtle bias just because I own a condo here now and I don't want to see the industry tank and have my condo not worth anything anymore. So, but it's a goofy example, but it just shows you how we all really have a stake in what we're reporting on, and it makes it all the more difficult. So I wanted to start with Claudia to see, how do you contend with that balance? How do you maintain that balance, walk that very fine line?
Well, I believe that we're all going to face conflicts in life, one way or the other. And it's a question of how you manage them. And so my husband actually works in the oil industry. And when stories break and they get a little close to home, I just back off. I just you approach things with a high level of personal integrity. You listen to as many sides as you can. You go and do the work on the ground. I think it's very, very important for us to get away from the city, from the oil bubble here, and go and talk to as many people outside who have different perspectives as possible. And I can tell you that my husband and I have lots of very, very lively discussions about everything from British Columbia environmentalists to U.S. politics, and we don't often agree. But I think the bigger problem here is your opinions are very much based on what you know, we're so exposed to what goes on to the oil industry all the time that you tend to have this huge body of knowledge on the oil industry, and you tend to have less knowledge for different perspectives, right? And so the challenge is always making the effort to reach out to people, to really go and spend the time in Kitimat and talk to the guys at the Haisla Nation and find out, well, why is it that you're so opposed to Northern Gateway? And are those concerns founded? So I try to do a lot of that, to be on the ground, to talk to people firsthand. And if anything, I'm so aware of the fact that there's all this noise here that I really try to make the extra effort to go out there and understand the other side of the picture.
But then, of course, do you always have the time, right? That's with the constant deadline pressure.
That's right. Now it's a question of time. It's also a question of budgets. So so we used to be able to travel a lot more. That's not as easy. To do, you really have to justify your trips and so on. But so far when opportunities have come up, the boat has been pretty good about allowing us to travel. So that's key.
Deborah, did you want to?
Well, I became into the journalism world a little bit differently because I worked as an investment banker. So I had the opportunity to make a lot of different connections within the industry, both at a different level, not just within the companies. And so that's given me a platform from which to spring beyond Calgary quite easily, not just in Toronto, but into New York and into Europe as well. So that gives me different perspectives as well. And my husband just retired from being a partner at First Energy Capital Corp, which is an energy investment bank. And I actually, like Claudia, wouldn't even ask him questions about what was going on because I didn't think that I wanted to put him into a position where he could be compromised or I could be potentially compromised and be looked at as spouting whatever First Energy was thinking. So it's a line that you have to tread very carefully, but I think it's really important to make sure that you leverage and expose yourself to as many people and different sources that you can. And, you know, yes, we live in a bubble and sometimes it's easy to stay in that bubble, but I think When Crosby Cotton hired me, he was all about fairness, accuracy, and balance. So I always keep that in my head when I'm looking at what I need to talk about.
So I'm going to bring in the other two panelists here, and I actually want to broaden it out a little bit because this notion of perspective is really fascinating in the by country is not right, but the two countries, Canada and the United States, the perspective on this sector is remarkably different. Jillian, I believe you even did some research to that effect to see that it's almost night and day the way Canadians view the oil sands. We'll stick with the oil sands as opposed to the Canadian energy space writ large, just for simplicity's sake, versus Americans.
We did some research at Mount Royal on this particular topic. We actually talked to about 20 journalists who are working not full time, but doing a lot of work around the oil sands. And we also looked at some other kinds of surveys that have been done in terms of what the coverage of the oil sands, what it's about in Canada. And we found that the majority of articles about oil sands development actually appear in business sections of newspapers. Or if they're not in the business section of newspapers, they actually have a business angle. I was actually, to be honest with you, I was quite surprised about that, but it's like something like 60 to 65% of the stories in newspapers, and these are national newspapers, big newspapers, about the oil sands are in business sections or have a business perspective to them. So certainly on the part of journalists in Canada who are working in this sector, they're writing about it from a business point of view. And we had a conversation on the phone the other day and discovered something quite interesting. You can take the rest of it.
Well, I'll comment to that, but first I want to say that my family and the Obama family have one thing in common. None of us are in the oil industry.
Yeah, I don't either.
So, for better or worse, and that's my one confession tonight. But we were discussing this, and in the American media, but now I work for the business section of the New York Times, so my coverage is a bit off this theme, but most of the coverage in the American media has been in environment with an environmental viewpoint when it comes to the oil sands. Looking at it, and in fact, when I was a foreign correspondent here in Canada, I remember doing several stories. There were some business stories, I remember a couple that I did, and then there were other stories that were environmental. Actually, I was pretty balanced in that way, but most of our coverage is on the environmental implications, because that's where the debate is in the United States when it comes to, you know, the Keystone Pipeline.
Except for the Wall Street Journal does look at it from a more of a business standpoint as opposed to environmental standpoint.
Why is the debate that's there, true. Though? Is the question I would, what pushed the debate there? Because I think that's one thing that tends to, forgive me, to baffle Canadians to a certain extent, is how Americans, at least from our perspective, they appear to not even care about the economic case of the oil sands.
Well, I found, I mean, I'll turn that around. When I was here, I found it surprising that there wasn't more conversation about the environmental implications of the oil sands in Canada. So I see it as both a business story. It's extremely important, not just, well, now I cover business and I cover the business of energy. So when I look at Canadian oil sands today in the Canadian oil patch, I'm looking at a multifaceted story. I'm looking at the Keystone Pipeline and all the facets of that, because that's a major political issue in the United States, and it's entwined in the process of becoming more independent as a country and as a North American continent. I'm looking at it as Canada is an important player in the international stage as a major supplier of oil in the world, mostly to the United States, but it's a global commodity. It's also a very, very important asset for huge American companies and other multinationals. So it has many facets to it, but there's no escaping if you're a U.S. journalist covering this, and that includes the Wall Street Journal. Keystone Pipeline is going to be in every story about the oil sands.
Why?
It is, well, for many reasons. First of all, it's a major project, and it's a defining line. Every energy story is also an environmental story, and every environmental story is an energy story. We need energy, we need a clean planet. There is a natural tension between having both. The environmentalists will say we've got to get off fossil fuels. Obviously, that is an impossibility in the short term. There are a lot of people in the oil community who say, drill in the United States, drill everywhere. Drill on federal lands. We need to look at these two issues, the environment and energy, together. They come together. On the pipeline itself, it's become a defining issue politically. It was a major issue in the last presidential campaign. It's a wedge issue. It's a wedge issue between Republicans and Democrats. It's a wedge issue within the Democratic Party, between the labor wing and, you know, environmental young people wing, and of course this is the tensions within the White House. So it's intrinsically interesting as a story, and of course it's very, very important. I did a story, and it was an unusual one in the U.S. press, about what this means for U.S.-Canadian relations. That gets lost in the coverage. Not my coverage, but generally speaking, it's not an issue. What,
it's on page 30, maybe.
I find it very interesting reading some of the very interesting articles, many of them columns, just the last couple of days in Canada, about how could the Harper government sell this better. And I thought that was very, very, I thought they were very interesting, and they made a lot of good points.
I just want to take up something what Cliff said, because obviously in the United States, it is, you said it's both an environmental and a business issue. And I think what's really interesting about what's happening in Canada and in the major media organizations, and certainly in Alberta, is that we don't actually have anybody that's working full-time on wetlands coverage. It's unbelievable, but we don't.
It feels like it.
It feels like it, but I
should stop by my office.
But as far as I know, maybe the Fort McMurray newspaper is probably the only one that has somebody on it full-time. There is, as far as I know, and please stand up and correct me, it's not true, we don't have somebody doing full-time on it also.
Actually, I can't correct you there.
So we don't have a cluster of people that could be doing the business and the environment and the social and actually bringing it all together.
Can I just say something just to reply to what you said about it not being as much of an environmental story in Canada? And when you were here. So when I was still working as an investment banker, I worked on the IPO for Suncor in 1992. And I remember going to, you know, whatever floor of some building downtown Toronto and listening to the whole story about Suncor and the operations and how they were going to make it more efficient and what it cost per barrel to produce the oil and where the growth was going to come from. The risk factors were not the environmental. I mean, it was not something we talked about. It was not something, it was not part of the due diligence process. We did not, that was not an area we focused on at all. And, you know, risk factors were commodity prices. And that was really what the concern was. And so, you know, from 1992, you've seen this whole evolution of how the focus has shifted. But part of that is that, you know, the industry itself has not felt the need to really explain itself or help the public understand how everything works and how things have changed over the years. But it was interesting just to think about that. Risk factors, and when you look at any prospectus, and I'm sure that if you looked at prospectuses today, there's a greater focus on the environmental liability. But even in annual reports until very recently, you didn't see a lot of discussion about environmental liability either. So this is something that's evolved in the conscious. I mean, in as much as investor relations wasn't a big deal in the energy sector, you know, 15 years ago, this is starting to change as well as companies realize that they have to be. That social license, if you want to use that word.
I come back about once a year. I've been back this year 23 hours, so I'm hardly an expert. But it feels like there's an evolution going on. It feels like the regulator here and the Alberta government is stiffening, and it feels like some of the people I'm talking to in the industry understand that, accept that, almost welcome that, and that this is part of a process of sustainability that is going to help over the long term on both sides of the border.
Nobody gets a carte blanche. And people are realizing that there's
a balance on both sides. That's not a bad thing.
No, it's not, and it's interesting because, as you say, the regulator, there was some there was a lot of huffing and puffing when the new regulator was put together,
right.
and Jerry Prati, who was formerly in the energy sector, was named to chair the board, and people were very concerned about that. But it's proving to have been the right model.
And now there's a lot of huffing and puffing about huffing and puffing.
That's right.
I think there's always been a little bit of that. But is that waking up process, is that not happening several years too late? You noted, you know, the 1992 mindset. There are many, many people, not just in this city, but all around the world, that would say that those executives are still in 1992 in their heads. And I think that people look at examples like the Primrose leak with Canadian Natural Resources and just the appalling way that they handled the media coverage of that.
And in
so doing, blew it up huge, made it an even bigger story than it might have otherwise been had they just been more open and more direct about the communications about it. So are we at a point now where it's almost too late for the companies to get their act together and really start to understand the way that people need to get information in real time. I mean, I know that every company out there has 5 or 6 people working their Twitter accounts and all that, and I'm following them all on Twitter. I've never once seen a useful tweet out of any of them, and I don't really see... Well, the National Energy Board has good tweets. I will single them out. but the idea that I'm trying to create here is that are we past the point where people are willing to trust what these companies have to say?
But I think also we can't ignore the role of government in this either. I mean, the whole issue of greenhouse gas emissions is really on the federal government's plate and on the Alberta government's plate, and that's been an issue since 2000. We're going on 15 years here, and still there's no actual plan. There doesn't seem to be one anywhere, not that I know about. And the government doesn't seem to want to move. And you hear
Kyoto.
All the time. Kyoto, yeah. You hear all the time, well, the government doesn't move because industry doesn't want to move. But at what point do you have to actually face reality and do something?
Well, I
just kind of have a bit of a different perspective. Just to come back to the question that you were asking about whether it's too late for companies to actually you know explain what they do, perhaps be a bit more open and so on. There's been a real evolution here. So in the early days of the oil sands, companies were actually really, really happy to talk about what they were doing. If anything, they were very concerned about the lack of interest in the oil sands. I mean, they were just all over the map trying to get anybody to pay attention to their processes, the fact that the industry was becoming economic.
But that's what it was. The focus was making it economic. It wasn't about anything else. The fact that you get out of the round and make a buck.
From trains to the trunks of trucks and shovels.
I mean, in the early days, you could go up to Fort McMurray and then they'll come and pick you up at the airport. They'll take you to the mines. And, I've actually been on a truck. I got to drive a truck. You never get that kind of treatment today.
Yeah, they showed me a wheel.
As close as
I got.
So what has happened is that the blowback from the environmental community has been so strong that the industry has really clammed up. And so now what we have is an industry that's very institutional, where information is extremely controlled, and where if they participate in any debate, it's really on their own terms, right? Everything has to be very packaged and it generally doesn't resonate as much. And so I'm not sure where we're going to go from here, really.
I got news for you. It's the same way south of the border. Maybe worse.
Sounds like you're saying it is too late.
I don't think it's ever too late. And I think it is evolving. But this is an industry that is, in a defensive crouch all the time. And I don't think it helps. No. I think that when you answer the phone and you're not scripted, because any good reporter knows when he or she is getting, something that's somebody is reading. You can tell. There are certain companies that I deal with on both sides of the border that are remarkably open, and there are others that will not answer a phone or answer an email.
So part of that has to do with what happened in the States with regulation full disclosure. Reg FD also compromised the way companies broadly communicate, and I think the more so for the energy sector because they're so worried about what the backlash might be. And that has actually compromised not only what the companies say, but also how the analysts break them down and what kind of access they get. That actually, you talk to anybody, they'll say there was a big inflection point when that when Reg FD came in, and that's just as an aside. But I think certainly some companies are starting to say, well, we're going to take it into our own hands and we're starting campaigns within our, to make everybody an ambassador so that everybody can talk about it. Because it really what it is, it's a lack of energy literacy. The energy sector is run by a bunch of guys, mostly, unfortunately, who are engineers, who have not been taught how to communicate and don't.
That's true.
That's been the easy route.
In the States now, you have, fracking is the big thing. Bigger than Keystone, okay, on a local level.
And what's happening is you've got, you know, in Pennsylvania, Colorado, different places, you've got these grassroots organizations that are rising up against fracking and different kinds of oil and gas operations. The companies that are involved, and there are several of them now, that are really fighting back, and they're doing it, but they're sending their people out door to door, they're engaging with journalists, and they tell me, we don't expect a pro hydrocarbon story in the New York Times, but if you and I have a, I think I have a good reputation in the industry, that I'm fair. If you put our side in the story and you listen to us and that informs the story, we're better off. And that, I'm getting that, not from everybody, but I think it would help. Not every story is going to be positive.
No, and the companies that tend to see the light are the companies that get in big trouble. And so,
I don't think so.
No.
Well,
I think it's just the opposite.
TransCanada, it's been night and day. I mean, TransCanada hardly ever responded to calls in the past,
The Earth Department would shut down at 5 o'clock, and there was no number to call afterwards.
Right, and now
how's that worked out?
They've been really responsive, and I think Enbridge has really changed that way. So a lot more access to
segments
and so on. I think it does help.
It does
help them to get their message out.
I think so. I thought you said it didn't help.
Yeah. So yeah, absolutely it does. Yeah.
Wow. Look what had to happen for that
them
to change.
Before they actually saw the light. Yeah. That's right.
So let's talk about how
the one thing that I find, no matter what the companies do though, the big difference between today and let's say 10 years ago is the blogosphere. And the amount of misinformation that is out there that is accessible 24/7, and no matter what somebody says, if somebody's looking for some information that's counter, there's no accountability. I was looking at some websites today just for the heck of it. So one of them was this website called Little Red Umbrella, and they were claiming, this was great, that the oil sands produced 170 billion barrels of oil in 2012.
Awesome.
It's the reserve number, yeah. So there's just so much misinformation that we subsidize the energy sector to $1.3 billion a year. Taxpayers do, but no mention of the economic activity that's generated on the other side. So there's so much misinformation.
But having said that, I agree with that. There's a lot out there that's, you wonder where it comes from. But having said that, I think a lot of the environmental NGOs have gotten a lot smarter and a lot more professional. And I think what happens, they actually do answer their phones or their texts or whatever way you communicate with them.
Right.
They get back to you right away. And, there is a bit of a misconception out there that they're all hotheads and they're all this, but there's a lot of actually quite professional people that actually understand a lot of the issues, and they don't have any trouble getting back to you.
Much of that is precipitated politically, of course, the idea of these environmental groups and these NGOs being front organizations for various other political actors, in the same way that people look at the Koch brothers and the Tea Party in the United States. And that just complicates the issue further. But one thing I wanted to get your collective reaction to was exactly how these companies are starting to respond. They're starting to fight fire with fire to a certain extent. A really good example, of course, you're all probably familiar with Neil Young and what happened with him taking a stand against the oil sands. So actually something out of Synovus that was particularly interesting. It was a clever way to get back. They took one of his older music videos and they put these little blurbs throughout the entire video saying, well, that needed oil. You needed oil to do that, Neil. And what about that? You can't do that without oil either. So this whole music video wouldn't work and this wouldn't work either. And it didn't... I watched it. I thought personally it was pretty clever and pretty good, sort of right back at you kind of fighting fire with fire. But nobody really.
Synovus is one of the best at being very, very open, and they have a story to tell. But I'll tell you, we talk about an American company in an American situation that you probably all have heard about, Chevron in Ecuador, right?
Mm-hmm.
For 20 years, this has been an albatross around Chevron's neck ever since they bought Texaco. And finally they decided, you know what, we are going to engage the media. And they started telling their story. And as they told their story, more and more facts came out. You probably all know that the lead attorney for, you know, the people down in Ecuador turned out to, you know, probably have paid the judge, written all of the testimony, just a total sham. And Chevron is off the hook, but they turned it around by saying, you know, people, and I've spoken to the people there, now they're opening up in other ways. We have a story to tell. We, you know, if you're a journalist and somebody's not calling you back, you start drooling. You start drooling, not literally,
sometimes.
Because you think, ah, they're hiding something. They're in the defense. They're defending. You know, in your personal relations, you can tell when somebody's responding openly and somebody's responding defensively, how you respond to them. It's the same way with us. When somebody opens up and talks and say, you know, that story you wrote really, you know, wasn't fair. You didn't mention this. You didn't mention that. I appreciate that. Fortunately, it doesn't happen too often. Or, you know, you could have mentioned this. Okay, let's talk about it. Then another story comes out of that. Instead of, oh, you know, it doesn't do any good to talk to them. It's always the same thing. And where does it get the industry? Nowhere.
So how do we actually get to a point where the industry, because, like, you know, we talked about Synovus is very good at getting their message out, but a lot of companies aren't so good. You know, there's
some of the good ones. I mean, Synovus is very good. Shell here and internationally is quite good.
But before we get into the list of good and bad, I just...
I mean, it seems like we're saying everybody is in a crouch. It's not everybody.
Some are in a crouch, some are not in a crouch. But how do we get everybody out of a crouch? They do, sometimes too much, but we can talk a little more about that later.
I think it's very cultural. You know, every company has their own culture, and a lot of it actually depends on the CEO. If the CEO is comfortable communicating, if he's, if he likes to build relationships, then generally the whole company will reflect that.
Is Husky a good example of the dichotomy there?
You're putting me on the spot here. I think that you know, under the new CEO, he's much more comfortable communicating. Under the old CEO,
it's way more visible.
The old CEO just didn't really believe in talking to the media. But I think that generally there's this belief in all companies that that they can sort of like get their message out to the people who matter to them. By really bypassing the media. So, you know, if they need to get to governments, they'll go and talk to governments. If they need to get to the investment community, they'll go and talk to the analysts in the investment community. You know, they'll tweet and they'll issue their news releases. And, they feel that they can reach the areas that they are comfortable with on their own, really. And so we are just another stakeholder to them, but we're certainly not a major stakeholder. This is my perception, there's this view that energy reporters in Calgary are a bunch of old company hacks. Well, that's, you know, it's so not true, because we have
we'd be paid a lot better, probably.
We probably get a lot better, yeah. But we work hard to get information, and most of the time we get the same stuff that everybody else gets, right? And so you kind of have to draw on your own knowledge and your own sources, and try to build stories out of the totality of what you know, as opposed to what the all company gives you.
Deborah, did you want to jump in?
It's so much of it comes down to building trust throughout any organization, and so the longer you're around in this covering the beat, the better your opportunity to do that. And so, having done this since 1997, there are a lot of very deep connections throughout the city that I've developed, and so that helps sort of broaden perspective and be able to look at things in different ways. But it's certainly, again, you go back to how the sector itself is communicated. And for when I was working as an investment banker, it was one thing. And then for a while I was doing investor relations, and I can tell you that it was very difficult to get the CEOs to go to conferences, to talk to the analysts in an open way,
and certainly to talk to the media, to try and get them to talk to the media in a way that the media would say, okay, I get the message you're trying to deliver. Like, we get press releases from Alberta Energy, and they were horrendous. You couldn't understand them. The language was very complicated. It was almost like they were obfuscating all the facts that they needed to get across. And over time, they realized, yes, we actually have to communicate. Yes, it's important. And there are some companies that have done really well with it, and some of them who still don't quite get it. And some of them are, you know, Canadian Natural Resources. Do they communicate the way they should for a company their size? That's an interesting conversation.
So one point, actually, Claudia, you mentioned is quite apt, this notion of an oil and gas journalist in Calgary and even elsewhere, arguably, are seen as just sitting in the front pockets of the companies that they cover. And one of the complicating factors there is this notion of custom content that many, many newspapers and broadcast outlets have been picking up. And it's a notion that Jillian, I wanted to get your, from an academic perspective on this, whether or not, because of course, the only reason people don't get their information directly from the companies is because they trust us more to actually find the middle ground and find the facts and report them as objectively as we can. But does the notion of custom content, where it's effectively an advertorial and the line becomes very, very skewed, does that hurt our case? Does it hurt our industry?
Oh, yeah, and we're seeing more and more of that right now, what's called sponsored kind of content.
Yeah.
And it's appearing in a way that you can't tell if it's that, it doesn't look that different from normal sort of content. And I think for the most part, people don't see a difference. And also because we're so flooded all the time anyway with information and promotion and marketing coming at us from all angles, that, yeah, I think it's very hard for journalists now to act, or journalism or news media organizations, to actually carve out a niche for themselves in which people can look at it and go say, well, yeah, that's credible, I trust that. You know, I think it's become quite blurred, the whole arena. And much more so than it used to be.
And with declining ad revenues, it's become all the more vital to go to these kinds of sources of revenue.
It's harder for us as journalists to carve out that niche where people can say, yes, this is a journalistic report, so therefore I give it, you know, this credibility. Or this person is writing and I know that they have a lot of integrity and they know they're smart and they know what they're talking about, so I can trust this. I think the lines are getting pretty blurred around that now, and it's harder and harder for distinguish what they can trust and what not.
So how do we sharpen up those lines? I know that the National Post has a joint venture with the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, and one thing I've noticed that they've actually, the Institute, since after I was there, was that they'll actually put it right in the headline. They'll actually say, a joint venture with CAP. It's you can't miss it. You know that it's not, and there's no reporter byline or anything like that. It's very clearly different from other National Post content, but there's no real set guidelines or rules. I mean, the National Post, just, they're doing their own thing. They're doing what they think is right. But nobody told them that that's what they should do. And do we need a set guideline of principles to make sure that people are able to tell that what they're reading is credible or should be seen as credible or should be taken with a grain of salt?
Again, the whole field is sort of in flux, and it's hard to know anymore what is what. I think it's harder and harder for people to figure it out.
I think, you know, if the lines appear blurred, I think it's mostly a reader issue. I can tell you that the way that we cover the energy sector has not changed at all. It's not stopped us from asking the tough questions, from writing stories that might be critical of CAP, or columns that might be critical of CAP,
right,
or stories that might be critical of companies. There's absolutely, there's a Chinese wall, and we keep doing the things that we were doing before. And again, it comes back to your own personal integrity, right? And your own judgment, and you see a story that needs to be covered, or something that needs to be said, and you say it regardless.
But the buck does stop with the reader, though, and that's the issue, is that someone might see, say, one of your stories, and they might wonder, whether regardless of the integrity and the content of that one story, they might see it in the larger package of content. And I know that I'm not implying a specific case right here. I'm just saying hypothetically, they might not be so willing to trust it, and then that undermines our ability to encourage energy literacy and encourage people to understand facts more, because they're just increasingly skeptical of everything that they see. And, you know, like to Deborah's point about this huge influx in the blogosphere and the idea that there nothing is credible, therefore everything is credible at this point. And so, I mean, I'm almost at a loss, because I'm not sure where we can get out of that cycle.
Well, I think what we really have to keep reminding the public is that when you read a newspaper, you read it online, or you actually read the paper, there are editors that are involved that are looking at what you're writing and making sure that you're not crossing the lines and maintaining, as you know, the fairness, accuracy, and balance, for lack of a better description, in what you're presenting. And so, you know, the big differentiator for me is editor versus no editor. And that's the message I don't think the public is really understanding when they decide to consume the news media as it's being presented.
So, Clifford, I want to bring you into this conversation, and perhaps we can get an American perspective on this, because I don't get a chance to read a lot of American media these days, but I don't see the New York Times doing a lot of this. But actually, in the process of preparing this, I was forwarded something about the Denver Post pushing even further into the notion of custom content, to the extent that they're actually removing banners and things on their website so that they were just articles mixed in with all the other articles. And a lot of them are, they're almost, I read a few of them this morning, they're interesting in that they don't make a really strong case for, say, fracking was one of the articles I read about. They made it seem almost like they were taking this middle-of-the-road approach to try and fool people into thinking that this is actually a reporter who did this, because we raised some criticisms, and the criticisms were quickly thrown asunder because, of course, it was an advertorial, it was custom content. So, I mean, what is the American perspective on this? Is this something that's part of the conversation?
I read generally 3 newspapers a day, and that's not a problem in the ones that I read. And that's the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Houston Chronicle. And the Times and the Journal will have sections that are advertising, but they're clearly, you can see they're advertising. It says they're advertising. And I don't have a problem with that. But I do have a problem with what you're describing. I mean, that's horrendous.
But there's no real clear-cut, of course, Jillian talking about these unwritten rules.
That's a failure of the newspaper. I'd like to see that.
Sure.
Because I haven't seen anything that egregious.
I hadn't heard about it until it was forwarded to me.
I don't generally read the Denver Post. I believe you. I think it's, you know, that probably comes out of some kind of desperation, and good moves don't come out of desperation.
Generally not.
I guess one thing that kind of needs to be said is at the end of the day, we get the media that we deserve. Right, and
ouch.
And yeah, and unfortunately, that's you know
the democracy we deserve.
Every one of us deserve that.
if readers are not willing to support the work that we do because they don't want to pay for the content, or advertisers don't want to pay for the ads, we are a business. We're not a public service, and unfortunately, we need income like everybody else.
I guess I'm a professional reader, and I'm reading all day as well as reporting and writing, and I don't use Facebook, but I do use Twitter, and I follow. 200 people out there who are feeding me essential information every day. I am, Googling particular subjects, including oil sands and Keystone Pipeline, every day, and I'm finding all kinds of stuff. I have more good content today, and I've been in this business about 35 years, than ever. Mm-hmm. And I know there's some junk out there. And I know it's junk right from the start. I can tell it's a screed. It's somebody with a point of view. I have nothing against a point of view, but one that's not well thought out. And that just goes right into the garbage bin.
But not everybody has those critical thinking skills.
I know.
And that's the problem.
And that's, I mean, that's, I mean, maybe that's what Claudia was getting at.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, that's democracy, right? I mean...
So we get the media that we deserve, and arguably we also get the political leadership that we deserve. And
when Benjamin Franklin founded the Montreal Gazette, I'm sure the standards were not great.
It's a historical perspective that you're bringing. I like that. Probably Benjamin Franklin wouldn't have been screaming his head off about this energy project or that energy project to a Canadian prime minister.
He just wanted Quebec, you know.
I would probably give it to him at this point. I can say that in Alberta.
Oh boy.
But getting back to the question at hand, the political issue is so new. It's really something that we haven't been able to get our head around. And while we talk about the idea of companies getting their message out, they have some help in the form of these political leaders. But is it really help? This is what I'm wondering. I mean, at a certain point when we have our foreign minister going down to Washington, D.C. and giving the diplomatic equivalent of a hissy fit about a decision for a single project that really isn't as important as everybody makes it out to be, even TransCanada says it's not that important to them, then, I mean, are we better off, are our politicians, at least from an American perspective, better off just shutting up?
Well, now you're asking, I'm not going to comment on the strategy of your government, but I have to tell you, I do think that there are, I have to be careful here, because I'm not for the pipeline, and I'm not against the pipeline, and I try not to think one way, I don't go there. But I am a little bewildered that the U.S. government and the Canadian government aren't talking in a more pragmatic way about some kind of a grand bargain that would include the pipeline and maybe a continental effort on carbon.
Deborah's written about that very subject.
It could be very, very interesting. That could, you know, that's a story I'd like to write about. But I don't see it happening.
Why not?
I don't know. I'm not in Washington. I'm not in Ottawa. I don't get it. It's like...
I think it's safe to say that both the federal government and the Alberta government have really, they are promoters and marketers of the energy industry, and particularly of these pipelines that are in question right now. They've become promoters and marketers. Whereas if you look back over the years, particularly at the beginning of oil sands development, they were much more circumspect. Sure, they wanted the oil sands developed, particularly when Peter Lougheed got in there and kick-started it. But you know, the governments were, particularly the Alberta government, was doing a lot of research into environmental issues, into social policy issues, into long-term effects of this development, as well as the economic kind of development. They're not doing hardly any of that anymore. They have, since probably about the 1990s, basically they've turned most of the kind of let's go ahead kind of thing over to industry, and they've become marketers and promoters for industry. And as a result, you get your resource minister basically condemning all environmentalists instead of the federal government and the Alberta government actually trying to facilitate some kind of
that's not going to help south of the border.
No.
That
attitude.
Right.
No.
Yeah.
That's not going to help with the Obama administration.
No, not at all.
That's pretty evident. But when you just sort of hit the 90s. When you look back, as you mentioned, Jillian, about the oil sands starting and the work that was done, we had a very visionary premier who had a very long-term time horizon. And if you look back at his speeches in the 1970s, he was talking about Japan as a potential customer for the oil sands and how they may be interested in investing and how else to attract other investment. But also, he was also very mindful that you had to build bridges, whether they were into Asia or they were into Washington, and you had to build those bridges well in advance of needing to use them. And that philosophy was something the Lougheed government was very mindful of. And when he left office, that fell off a cliff. We haven't had that, those threads are gone. And Premier Redford, former Premier Redford, was trying to reestablish those threads. She's doing all she could to do that.
One of the
I have a different point of view. I think that our governments absolutely had to jump in and talk about what we were doing here, because it was not just a pipeline that was being criticized in the United States and elsewhere. It was basically like it was our whole economy dependent on fossil fuels. It was our regulatory system. We probably have the best regulatory system for energy projects in the whole world. People come here and copy what we do. And yet, the decisions that were made were being questioned as if, people here were a bunch of incompetent, greedy, oil hacks. Yeah. And with the oil industry not really standing up and speaking for itself, somebody had to do that.
You actually saw better.
And let's not forget that our governments are huge partners in this industry. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not just the royalties and it's the taxes. It's a big part of the economy. Of course, they have to defend it. You know, it's like a lot of Canada has been it has been scrutinized and there was an information vacuum, and that information vacuum had to be addressed. And I actually think the Alberta government, the Saskatchewan government has done a great job, and our federal government has done a great job. And our embassy in Washington has done a great job as well.
And yet we're still in this position where to tell average American or even average Canadian that there's in fact 16 oil pipelines spanning the Canada-U.S. border and that Keystone would be number 17 is a fact that would fall on deaf ears to the entire continent at this point.
Yes, but I think that the fact that Canada has been so aggressive has really helped move public opinion in the United States. Hmm. And so, for example, a poll just came out today saying that actually support for Keystone has gone up. Huge support in Congress, I guess both on the part of Republicans and Democrats.
I'm pleased you brought that up, actually.
And also, I think by and large, the mainstream media in the United States is supportive of Keystone. And that's a big change. You know, it took a lot of work to get there.
We're still waiting for a positive editorial
in
New York Times.
Don't count on it. By the way, I have nothing to do with the editorial page.
Right. Yes, we discussed
absolutely,
that.
Absolutely. I know people here may not believe that, but I have nothing to do with what they write, and I don't even read the page that much. But now I'm in trouble. No, I'm not. It's interesting what you say about how people support it in the United States. I haven't read that poll. I think it depends on how you, what the poll says. I think that there is a general recognition that there are jobs involved. And there's the intensity of the opposition among the environmental community, which is part of the Democratic base, and young people. This is something that a lot of people don't understand in the energy industry, where young people are. Now, they may change their mind when they get older and wiser. Young people generally don't like fossil fuels on college campuses on either coast. And these are the people who, to a large extent, were an important part of the Obama base. On the other hand, you've got labor unions, you have the Republican Party, you have Democrats from, oil states. The country, in case you folks haven't, noticed, the United States is a very divided country right now. And one of the fault lines is this pipeline. I think, I've been saying the Obama administration will eventually go along with the pipeline now for 3 years, and I've been wrong for 3 years. And I think that given a reason like something that Obama can take to his base that would make the pipeline a little bit more palatable.
You're talking about carbon policy.
Yeah. And again, this is, you know, please don't, this is not my advice to one government or another. I'm just looking at this, I think, you know, from, you know, as an abstraction. That you could, because you're right, Claudia, there's a lot of support. I mean, most people, you say, are you concerned about climate change? Most people will say, yeah, you know, the weather's sandy, there's that. But put it on the list of things, and it's low. But now look between 18 and 28 in the United States, and it's liable to be high. You know, it's up there with, you know, marriage rights, you know, for gay people. This is like a big deal for a certain segment of the population that is very supportive of this administration and helped elect it.
I'm going to pause you there for 1 second. I just want to make sure we have enough time to get some questions from the audience. If anybody has any questions at all for our panel, I ask you to head up to that microphone right there. And this is Jeopardy rules that we're applying here, so please make sure you ask in the form of a question and announce who you are, who your affiliation with, and we'll see what we can do to start a big argument about it.
All right, Chelsea Earhart here. I work in environmental markets, so that's kind of my confession. I really believe in market-based mechanisms for carbon regulation. So my question is going to be about Alberta's specified gas emitters regulation, carbon pricing, and carbon offset programs. And specifically, what your opinion is on the importance of this program for Alberta to regain its social license to operate. And then further, what are the expected changes to the carbon price and the intensity reduction requirement, and what the expected changes are going to be versus what might be necessary in order for Alberta to maybe dream of a day when our oil is branded as a low carbon intensity barrel and we can export it under that brand?
Like California Heavy.
I can start us off. I mean, of course, we all want to see for greenhouse gas regulations for the oil and gas industry. We've been waiting for this stuff for a long time from the federal government. We would like to see, I mean, I'd like to see a higher price for carbon for the big emitters here in Alberta. I think it would go some way to gain acceptance for the oil sands, but my caution is that we would get zero credit for it. And in fact, look at all the money that's being put into carbon capture and storage. A lot of that is government money. It's $1 billion of government funds that's been taken away from other programs for healthcare and education. We are getting zero credit for that from the environmental movement.
But Claudia,
and so you kind of wonder why. Yeah, I guess one of the reasons why these regulations, for example, the federal regulation that have been held back, is because you know we're at risk here of making our own industry uncompetitive versus the U.S. industry, which doesn't have those regulations, versus other other oil producers, and potentially get nothing in return.
Well, let me just say this. First of all, in California Heavy, the same people that want to shut down Keystone want to shut down California Heavy too.
So why are we talking about that?
Go to California, okay? It's a big issue. And in fact,
oil sands are a big issue outside of Alberta.
The people I speak to in California don't realize that the California thermal barrel is
maybe
heavier.
But anyway,
than,
but you know, carbon capture and sequestration is a great idea. You can put a few billion dollars into it, and you know, in 30 years, you might have some
right.
project. I mean, that is so long term, unfortunately, and it's so expensive that, I mean, it's too bad we didn't start doing this 30, 40 years ago, you know, because, so, you know, you can say you put a lot of money into it and everything, but what impact is that gonna have in the next 15, 20 years? It's important as a start. That's not going to turn everything around. But to say that, you know, working hard isn't going to do mitigation, isn't going to help, I don't think that's true. I mean, I came up here last year. The last story I did from up here was about all the efforts that were being made by COSIA and the company. Cenovus took me up and they showed me, and it is impressive. And it needs to be written, and it was written.
For sure. It is. But what kind of credit are we getting? Look at the guys who are protesting against Keystone itself. And you know, their view is that the oil sands are, they should be shut down.
Yeah, but you're talking about the activists. You're not talking about the general population. Those people will not be satisfied until every oil rig is, like, disassembled. That's not your audience. That's not your mainstream. That is a certain sector of the population.
That's influencing policy in the White House, and it's been influencing policy in the EU as well.
I think there are other players, other stakeholders that are also important. That's not the only. You know, some people who, you know, chain themselves to the fence at the White House, they make an impact, but they're not the only people who have a voice.
We're going to take another question. I see a gentleman waiting patiently there.
Thank you. My name's...
Can we get the microphone up, please? Go ahead.
My name is John Mickelson. I'm actually with an environmental NGO. And this is perhaps a question, but maybe even a comment. First of all, the activists are funded in a big way. Secondly, you did talk about the NGOs answering the phone. The reason they answer the phone is they don't have a plug nickel to rub together. The government does not fund NGOs, and they fund social services, and I'm not saying that's wrong. But there's a lot of mistrust between NGOs and industry, and there's a lot of NGOs out there who would like to be intermediaries with that. And I don't understand why, when we are hit and slammed with environmental issues every day, and especially Alberta, and misleading information, et cetera, that there's no one out there talking about and or supporting fledgling NGOs.
What we need is a conversation, not a debate. And one of the things I've asked energy CEOs is, let's, if you're really committed to the environment and really committed to looking at things a bit differently, why is there not somebody who's from that world on your board? Because if you do that, then you send a message that you're actually committed to looking at things through a different lens. You're prepared to be challenged at the boardroom table, and you're prepared to look at things in a way that needs to move forward and address the issues that are potentially stopping you from achieving your corporate plans, whatever they are.
Well, I do have to apologize for one second, because in our case, we have a number of major ONGs in this province that do support us, and they are the Cenovuses and the Suncors. RBC, which is another one, so they do actually sit on a board of ours as well. But
I'm
they
talking
are
about
certainly
the other way
not
around.
CEOs.
I'm talking about the oil companies having environmental people at their board at the boardroom table.
Okay.
And so that, I think, that's the one piece that still needs to be looked at. To you know, people don't go on boards to engage in conflict, but I think a healthy board is one that actually accepts the fact that the conflict does arise. And if this is an increasingly important issue for a company to be able to carry out its business plan, then perhaps it's something that needs to be considered.
Can I say something that's happening south of the border? That's happening in Colorado right now.
There's a...
Where you have this, you know, environmental movement from the grassroots, and certain companies, and I'm thinking in terms of Noble, and there are a couple of others, Anadarko, that are engaging with environmental NGOs, coming up with, you know, air pollution plans, this and that, and then suddenly people notice that.
Yep.
People go, whoa, wait a minute. You know, I mean, maybe not people who are chaining themselves to a fence, but others are going, huh? You kind of look twice, because I haven't met a corporation, energy other otherwise, that doesn't say, I care deeply about the environment. There isn't one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's take it away from the energy business. They all say that. Talk is cheap.
Yeah.
And It's but when you're actually making that, you know, saying, okay, come on in, how can we do better? That kind of engagement is noticed.
It seems believable, is the point.
Yeah. Very credible. And it can work.
Miss, if you want to go ahead with the next question.
Thanks. I'm Rosemary Enslin. I'm in the public relations business and just really appreciate you all being here. Would you speak a little bit about the complexity of this subject? And I'd like to hear a little bit more about what Jillian was talking about that combined kind of coverage. And when I think about what you are graduating in journalism in J schools, the journalists that are coming out and a bit of your findings, but I'm very interested in the complex and having you talk about the complexity of covering this whole field. And as communicators, of course, the time that we spend explaining the very basics of, it's almost going back to geology class and trying to explain oil extraction and fracking and what is all this and what is an oil sand and how did it get the name tar. And it's so when you're trying to communicate in a Twitter world. So I'd really like to kind of hear a little bit about, we have a bit of time, but.
Needs to be in the form of a question, remember. Okay. I can get Alex Trebek out here if I need to.
Typical PR, I've got to get into the paragraph, I'll get it. Jillian, the whole conversation about the journalists that are coming out, how are they being equipped to cover this complexity? The time it took all of you to get your hands into it and who how you got your training and to be able to understand the subjects, because again, so complex.
Yeah, no, it is a very complex subject. And certainly at Mount Royal in journalism, we are actually starting to figure out how we can actually really create kind of either a course or a center where we would actually become kind of one of those places where students can actually learn about this kind of thing, because it's so important in Alberta. And it is something that the young journalists need to be literate about. They need to be able to understand all those issues. I mean, it's a business story, it's a, environmental story, there's social, there's all kinds of things involved in it. And I think, I said earlier that there, I think somebody wanted to correct me, there wasn't anybody doing full-time oil sands coverage. But, we need to create these places in Alberta where people can learn about this stuff. And from all angles, not just from the business angle, but from all angles, so that the complexity actually can be made a little clearer for people.
Can I ask a question? Who's going to fund that?
Well, that's a question, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the other thing too is to look at the journalism model a little differently and look at people that are within the industry who can actually move out of industry and into journalism. That's a different path, but that's when you can add value. And I think that's a piece that's in this particular industry, which is so complicated. If you can have that movement happening, then you have a different perspective that you can offer, and it's of value. And then, for whatever news media that you're working with or for, they benefit as well, because it's a different level of credibility.
But I can tell you that, as somebody who never had anybody in their family in the oil business, that I remember the first time, I guess it was Suncor, when I visited the mine up there years ago, and I was not a young reporter, and how lost I was, and I remember the first time going to a refinery in Mexico and how lost I was. And, there's a learning curve. I've been doing this now full-time energy for 8 years, and it's amazing how much I learn every day. There's just so much to this industry. I don't think you learn it in journalism school. I think you learn it by doing it. You need to have the curiosity. You got to stay with it. And it's amazing for me, every story, it's a little less so now, but there's a steep learning curve, because sometimes I've got to get into the geology, or I have to get into the engineering.
Or chemistry.
The politics are easy.
You got to get into the chemistry. Yeah. Into the chemistry.
Yeah, you can get down to a molecular level, and sometimes you have to. And you just struggle with it, and you get it. This beat is not for everybody.
No, that's true.
I just wanted to add that, our business is obviously struggling. It's well known, but the the area of energy journalism is actually thriving. We have a great cluster of reporters here and columnists, and it's actually really unusual. So very high quality people, but they're people who have been in the industry generally for a very long time, who've done this for many, many years. And I did a lot of my learning in the early days of my career, so I've been covering the sector for about 20 years. And I think that one of the, I owe it to a lot of the companies that at the time were very open and were very happy to talk about what they were doing, to bring it to their rigs and show you what was going on and talk about their operations and so on. And unfortunately, I think that one of the problems with industry not being as open as it was in the past is the fact that that opportunity for learning is just not there anymore.
I want to second that as the person on this panel who has by far the least amount of experience in the, on the energy beat, that it's a challenge to get the information that you need.
And I think people were open until there were a couple of stories that were critical, maybe unfair, and were bruised, and then said, you know what? I'm not going through that again. It's not worth it. You have, the media people who are caught in between those of us who are looking for a hot story to write about and the executives who want an oil and gas journal piece. And that's all they want, or they want to read the piece before it goes in, which some of the trade journals do, and we don't do that. And I think, and this is easy for me to say, of course, but there are going to be, for those of you who are in the industry, there are going to be some stories that are going to be critical. There are even going to be some stories that are inaccurate and unfair. I think those stories don't have staying power, by the way. I think the truth emerges, usually, not always, but usually. I think the Chevron case in Ecuador may be an example of that. And you have to be able to, you take some knocks, but at the end of the day, if you believe in your story, you promote that story. Mm-hmm. Now, I've never been in public relations. You've been on both sides, but that's my perspective.
Now, we could definitely talk about this for a while, but I see waiting patiently in the wings. My vision is not so good, but I believe that's Jason Markusoff, the esteemed Calgary Herald civic affairs writer. Am I wrong? Oh, good to see you, Jason.
Your sight in the lights is very good. I don't cover business. I did cover provincial affairs. You guys were talking a lot about the various industry group industries, so industry companies, and how they relate differently. But oftentimes, there's a lot written, and a lot of interviews for CAP, and a lot of coverage of what CAP does, and what in the States what API does. How effective do you think those organizations are at really aggregating the industry opinion? And what's your approach to speaking to them or speaking to individual companies or other groups?
CAP is, if you're looking for information or a perspective, particularly from whether it's regulatory or political, situations that are unfolding, is great. I have personally been critical of CAP in terms of how it is approached the communications aspect of what it needs to do as the industry association and be part of that conversation in terms of advocating for the energy sector and sort of bridging the gap in terms of promoting energy literacy. So it's the first place to start in many respects to find out they have experts. The API is the same in terms of trying to figure something out, but I think you have to, that's point A, and then you go different directions.
Are they really representative, and has that shifted over time as this debate has evolved?
Well, it's interesting, just as an aside, interesting situation. And when CAP responded to Neil Young's, when Neil Young was here, somebody phoned me and said, okay, tell me why a fossil was responding to another fossil. Why isn't somebody like Nahid Nenshi communicating on behalf of CAP? Because that demographic understands how to talk to the 18 to 28-year-olds that Cliff was talking about. We don't need another, this is not my words, this is somebody else's words, another dead white man telling us why the energy sector is important.
There are a lot of 18 to 28-year-olds, to Clifford's point, supporting energy as well, though. So he walks a fine line.
Right, so but what I'm saying is there needs to be a bit of a different approach.
I'll tell you, I find CAP and API extremely helpful, both, for my work. I wish that and unfortunately what happens is a number of cases, the companies lean on, I don't know, I can't speak for CAP on this, but API and want API to do everything, carry all the water, and that's not enough. But I have found both organizations to be very, very helpful.
And in the survey we did of journalists who are covering the oil sands, a significant number said that they relied on CAP, particularly for statistics about the energy sector. And although there was also a